Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many Ohio school districts are considering linking teacher pay raises to performance, and at the same time, teachers are being asked to handle more pressure from administrators whose own success depends on the output of the classroom, more scrutiny by the public, more testing, more students in the classroom, and a new Ohio law requires teachers to be trained to spot students at risk of suicide. And then there's the idea of training teachers as first responders and even arming them. That's arisen since the tragedy in Connecticut in December. But what about just creating successful teachers who can motivate and educate their students? What makes a great teacher? Joining us now to talk about that is Tim Dove. He's a 30-plus year classroom veteran, a two-time Ohio Teacher of the Year, and a seventh-grade social studies teacher at Phoenix Middle School and Worthington City Schools. He's also taught teachers at the graduate level for many years. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Dr. Belinda Gimbert. She's associate professor in the OSU School of Educational Policy and Leadership, and Dr. Dean Crystal, in the OSU School of Education and Human Ecology. They'll be joining us in just a minute. But first, Tim, I wanted to ask you, and we can kind of carry this through the conversation throughout the hours, how much does this just have to do with personality and the human interaction and the clicking with the student and students clicking with the teacher and some not clicking with the teacher? How much does it all boil down to something that we absolutely cannot quantify?
Well, personality has become a tricky thing to talk about, because when you talk about a classroom teacher having 150 to 180 students, you're going to be dealing with lots of personalities.
Right.
So personalities you have to be careful with, because if you start to try to figure out and put people in a box that way, it doesn't always work for your entire student population. So I've been lucky enough that I work with teams of teachers, and we look at similar philosophies, but even having different personalities so that we can interact and connect with as many of our students, and we use those kinds of relationships to help each other out in terms of working with kids.
The idea then is not that personalities aren't necessarily about just having positive relationships, but different kinds of personalities make good teachers. I mean, do they tend to be organized people, or?
Well, you have a lot of different skill sets that have to be included. Years ago, there was a thing called an SRI perceiver that some school districts use as a way to initially screen people in looking at whether or not they would become successful educators or not. And there's a lot of other instruments out there to start to weed out what might make sense in terms of, do people really like kids? If not, you shouldn't be in a classroom. And what age level of kid, and where's your interest lie, and what do you keep coming back to that you're intrigued with? Because as a lifelong learner, and that's what you're trying to also model for other kids, that's something you're looking for in who's in front of the desk at the classroom as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Tim Dove. He's a seventh grade social studies teacher at Phoenix Middle School and Worthington City Schools. He's also a two-time Teacher of the Year in Ohio, and he has taught graduate students how to be teachers. As well at OSU and Capital University. If you have a question or comment for him, he'll just be with us for the first segment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dean Crystal, we were talking about personality at the outset. Is what Tim Dove was talking about kind of what you were talking about?
Yes, I agree with what Tim said, but something else I want to bring up, that a teacher should be passionate, passionate about the kids, like he alluded to, as well as passionate about what they're teaching. I remember when I was even in high school, one of my favorite social studies teachers, he was incredibly passionate, but a lot of kids really didn't see him as that interesting, but he loved the subject. And that's something that has always stayed with me and one of the driving forces to do what I do.
Yeah, I guess you're good. You know, different teachers are going to affect different kids different ways. You can't be all things to all people, right, Tim?
Well, that's true, but I also agree with the passion argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's basic sales, if you will. We sell the notion of being excited about being a lifelong learner every single day. You know, really when we were looking at what is it you look for really good teachers, even in terms of initial conversations with ones that are starting out, I really look for a few things when my interns would first come to my school. One, that they were not a clock watcher. Two, that they really wanted to engage with kids without being asked. If they did those two things, and they were passionate, if they actually did those three things, the rest of the pieces could be taught. But those three pieces are incredibly important, that work ethic and loving being with kids and being passionate about what you're doing. Really are the linchpins to success.
And maybe know thyself a little bit, because you can love kids, but junior high kids are different. And I know you love junior high kids, Tim. Junior high kids are different than high school or grade school. Belinda Gimbert?
A very wise professor said to me very early on in my teaching career is that you have to find something to like about every child. Every child can be irritating at times. Every adult can be irritating at times. But if you're able to find something about a child that you can connect with, then that gives you a strong foundation to be able to build a relationship with that child. And then that leads to the teacher being able to bring out the best in that particular student.
You know, I mentioned at the outset the new requirement that teachers be trained to identify kids who are at risk for suicide. And I was wondering, does it feel like more piling on, Tim, out there in the field? Or is that sort of an organic process that, yeah, you'd be looking for that anyways, or you would want to be able to help out in that regard anyway, and it's not that big of a deal?
Well, the trust. The sacred trust of being a teacher is a huge deal, but I don't know that that's anything new. If you really are paying attention to your kids, I mean, obviously you've been looking at high risk for a whole host of reasons for a long time, medical concerns, you know, what's set up in IEP to other health concerns. I mean, all those kinds of documents as well. You really are trying to individualize for each kid, whether they're on the initial radar or not. But the other problem with that is there are times when people will say, well, I never saw that coming. I'm not sure that you can assume that you know everything about every student that's in front of your face on any given day. But absolutely, you really work at trying to be aware.
Preparing us teachers at the college level, Dean and Belinda, do these kinds of these additional requirements, do they help, or do you just try to ignore them for the time being while you're getting people ready?
Well, to be honest, we have to discuss them. I mean, they have to become aware of what's going on. And I would say one of the things that we work very hard on is to get the kids, meaning the student teachers, in the schools early so they start recognizing the culture of schools. And so the things that now, as you say, being piled on, they're becoming more aware of it. They just aren't learning it at OSU in the classroom. They're learning it really at the school level. And I think that really helps the teachers really identify, is this really something they want to do with all these added responsibilities?
Something else about being a teacher. You're getting up and you're performing every day. You mentioned, Tim, you called it a sales job. But the customer is the toughest customer in the world, I would imagine. I've spoken to classrooms before, and they're very difficult from grade school up through college. They're very difficult, very tough customers. If you're thin-skinned, I would imagine that's a personality quality that wouldn't put you in very good stead.
Well, yeah, there is that. But I want to come back to what Dean also had said, is we can formalize this a bit. One of the things that I try to work with graduate students with early is to get outside of their own understanding of school. Because a lot of us that became teachers, honestly, were the winners, if you will, at schooling. What we are dealing with, though, is the entire community. So to get to know your kids in some appropriate formal ways, to see what kids struggle with, what they value, what they're interested in. And it doesn't matter whether you're a first-year teacher or a 30-year veteran. That changes from year to year, obviously. And to get to know kids as an individual to some degree helps you a great deal with navigating what's going on in their lives in relation to how you're also going to be teaching, in my case, social studies.
For parents who go and visit classrooms from time to time, they're not going to really get out of one or two visits, but things do seem a lot different than they were 30-odd years ago, 40, 50 years ago. In 1996, the National Commission on Teaching in America's Future made several recommendations, and one of them was to reinvent teacher preparation and professional development. And, Tim, how has that changed for you over time? Has it been reinvented, in your opinion? Has it changed much at all?
Oh, no, it absolutely has. Once upon a time, your focus was primarily on solely content. The methodologies were fairly limited. I mean, there was a range, but nothing like what we have today. There was the whole host of, I mean, we've always had the social issues as well in terms of what, how do you think broadly about the needs of kids. But what we've been trying to do is how do you make things presented to incoming teachers and veteran teachers to reevaluate, you know, what our knowledge of kids are, what our instructional planning and assessment looks like, how do we have a variety of active learning with our kids, how does technology play a role in that, and how does it not play a role in that, higher level thinking skills and questioning, a lot of the common core things, and that discussion has been very helpful in terms of looking at what is it we really are interested in doing in the 21st century, not as some new fad, but what is it really necessary for kids and teachers for them to be successful.
Also, I just want to bring up what Tim was saying about the 21st century learning. That's something that's very critical. In essence, that is bringing a lot of the ideas that we've learned in many studies and research in the last 100 years into some kind of formalized way, recognizing that kids need to work together in groups, solving problems, that sort of thing, as well as bringing in 21st century things like like technology into the classroom. So kids are really being prepared for the future, not being prepared just to do well in school.
Tim, before I let you go, I wanted you to comment on the whole idea of teaching to the test. Everybody's talking about teaching to the test. That's all teachers do anymore. Do you think that's really the case, or are those just the teachers who that just teach to the test are saying that?
Well, to me, it's always fascinating to even have the conversation with that phrase, because if you really are interested in kids mastering ideas and skills, we need to figure out what the assessments are ahead of time. And then what you do is you develop classroom activities and experiences for students to enable all of your students to be able to master those kinds of skills and understandings. It's not filling up time and then, oh, let's have a test about this. So it is very intentional teaching and learning. And it's a combination of daily going with kids, reviewing where they are in terms of understanding what's going on, so that teachers can adjust based on individual needs and classroom needs to make sure that they understand. So the whole notion of saying, are we teaching the test, is, to me, is like asking if an exam is easy or hard. If you understand the content, it's usually experienced as fairly easy. If you don't know the content, it's pretty ridiculously impossible. So the better question is, what are we learning? How are we learning it? And why are we learning it?
And are we assessing people on those things?
Exactly. And that's what the conversation is right now, both in terms of local school districts at the state level and also at the national level.
Tim, Dove, we have to say goodbye to you now. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for including me.
Tim Doves is a 7th grade social studies teacher at Phoenix Middle School in Worthington City Schools. He's also a 2-time Ohio Teacher of the Year, and he teaches teachers to be teachers. So stay with us. We'll continue our conversation about what makes a great teacher. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The life of a president has always provided rich fodder for biographers. President Obama is no exception. In just one term, dozens have already taken on his story. I'm Celeste Headlee, authors on Obama, the man, his life, his presidency, plus our weekly turn to the opinion page next time on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today, a high near 34, clouds tonight, and a low of 23 degrees. Sunny and back up to a high of 36 on Tuesday. Support comes from the Columbus Dance Theater, presenting the world premiere of Cleopatra with support from PNC Arts Alive, a performance that weaves dance, theater, music, and video on stage to bring this historical figure to life. Three shows, January 18th and 19th at the Lincoln Theater. Details at columbusdancetheater.com. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. We're talking about what makes a great teacher. What's your idea? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us, two professors from the OSU School of Education and Human Ecology, Dr. Belinda Gimbert, and also Dr. Dean Crystal. He teaches out at OSU Lima. If you have a question or comment for them, you're welcome to pose that as well, 614-292-8513. And Mary in Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, yeah, thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, yeah, what I wanted to state was when I was in graduate school to get my degree in secondary English education, one of my professors was saying that there was basically two types of teachers. One was kind of like methodical, organized, you know, kind of went by the book, this is how we do it. And the other type was more like creative, out of the box, flexible, if you will, that type of thing. And it's been my experience as a substitute teacher for the years that I did that, that I encountered more of the, you know, the real, you know, this is how we do it, this is the book. This is, you know, and the methodical type of teaching. And but I hear over and over again that our school systems are, you know, they're failing. It's like there's a disconnect between teaching methods and the kids that are supposed to be taught. And, you know, I was just wondering about that.
Belinda Gimbert?
Mary, you make a very good point. There often does seem to be this disconnect between the methodical teacher and those that the 21st century students seem to need, which is more of the creative, innovative, thinking out of the box type of skill set. And I think one of the most important things that we have to remember, and as we're preparing teachers and school leaders, is that the children, our millennial children, have access to technology tools and software that really promote relationship building skills these days. And many adults for a long time have struggled with how do they build those relationships with those students around the kinds of skills in the 21st century that a child needs to be able to learn and develop so that they are prepared for life after high school. So that creative, innovative teacher who is willing to explore technology and understand how our millennial children think and learn differently in the environments we create is very important. So part of our teacher preparation programs is really focusing on how do we revise the teacher prep curriculum that addresses those particular skill development for teachers and for school leaders.
Yeah, I couldn't believe my eyes. I was a sub, and the first period teacher was getting ready to leave, and they had the little TV shows in the morning, you know, right before homeroom. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about a McDonald's that had just opened up somewhere by Berlin or something. But the teenage girls were actually prostituting themselves for these McDonald's hamburgers. Now, this was some years ago, but after this, they said that on the news, the teacher comes up and shuts the TV off and says, okay, class, you know, blah, 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 get your papers together. And I thought, wow, what a teachable moment. You know, what an opportunity to talk about this, you know, or talk about how, you know, what people's values are or how they may change, you know. But like I said, it just seems to me that there are too many teachers that, for whatever reason, aren't using these opportunities, you know, to get these critical thinking skills going with the kids, to even understand what where they come from, you know, like what their background, what they're familiar with, the music they listen to, the TV shows they listen to, that type of thing. They're kind of like clueless.
That's interesting. You know, lots of times in grade school, you see on the bulletin boards, the kids' favorite, you know, they have different papers that they fill out at the beginning of the year with their favorite song, their favorite band, their favorite TV show, their favorite book, and that kind of a thing. Is that really to help the teachers usually, or what is that for?
Well, I think so. One of the things I tell pre-service teachers, people that are studying to be teachers, learn about the culture of the kids. What are the kinds of things that they're listening to, watching on TV, what are they doing online, that sort of thing really helps them not necessarily become their friend, but to identify and understand what these kids are doing. And that then brings a sort of a connection between the teacher and the kid. And then the kid then will then say, wow, this teacher is really a caring person. Maybe I ought to start listening to this person. And that starts carrying on. Because when you really think about it, if we think about what we're actually teaching kids, for example, teaching a kid a quadratic equation, why is that important? Really is such a part of what the kid is doing. So it's making those kinds of connections, then the kid will start listening to this teacher and start paying more attention and start really understanding why they are learning this particular content.
Mary in Lancaster, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Something that is brought up repeatedly, particularly in low-performing school districts, low-wealth school districts, that sort of thing, is the parent component. And I was wondering, to what extent are teachers taught how to deal with parents? A whole nother part of the equation, a whole nother set of personalities, really. And apparently critical in the whole process. Melinda?
Parents as partners is a critical role that pre-service teachers need to develop both within their prep programs and then as they move into their first years of teaching. And what we seem to find is it's that first time they have to engage in a dialogue with a parent, often they feel particularly uncomfortable. And so what we have seen in schools is teacher leaders and principals in buildings working with those pre-service teachers as they move into student teaching and then as they become first-year teachers and actually engaging in scenarios and role-playing situations prior to being, you know, put in the situation where they're dealing with a parent who for multiple different reasons, a parent that is maybe not even seeing the strengths of their child versus a parent that is very frustrated with the academic success of a child. I think sometimes we leap to the angry, upset parent, but quite often it's the passive, not engaged parent that you're also trying to develop that skill set with.
And in some schools, that's the person you need to engage and motivate. That's the problem. An email from Amy in Columbus. She says, I hear the experts talking about how teachers need to be passionate about teaching students and passionate about subject matter. This is ideal for teachers, but how can we expect teachers to sustain that passion over 30 years when there are failing levies, political pressures, and increasing demands on the job? There's some other points that she makes, but what about that, sustaining the passion? I think that's a really good point.
Right, exactly. I mean, one of the things that I think about is that schools will never be better places for kids than they also are for teachers and for the administrators in the building. So part of the strength of longevity of service for teachers comes from building that relationship with those in the building, a real sense of you know, being a buddy and being a colleague and a friend amongst their own staff. So how do we develop that culture within the school that also enables the teacher to be an individual, but also to be an individual within a team that is figuring out the best ways to academically and socially support and engage children? It's a challenge. There are. And we know in Ohio right now there are multiple policies that are making all sorts of different changes, heading in a direction that seems to be more around the collective sense. And it is very challenging.
Jeff, in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, thank you. And, you know, as listening, after being on the phone for about 20 minutes, and I'm not complaining, okay? I've seen the conversation kind of evolve from where I called in. And so I'm kind of put in a position where I like to say, boy, if there were one word or one phrase that I could sum the whole thing up, and miraculously, I think I've come up with one.
Okay.
And that is trust. Mm-hmm. You know, the subject matter is important. The test is important. But what is the most important thing in that classroom is the child. And until that child, without any holding back, really trusts you to do what's best for them, not what's best for the department, not what's best for the test, not what's best for the school, but what's best for them. And once they get that and you build that relationship with the child, it's a home run, but there's a dialogue, you know, there's a relationship on which to build. In the district in which I previously taught for physics for 40 years, for 30 years and 10 before that, there was this kind of, you know, you take it as a trite saying, every district's got, okay, what's our mission? But it was rigor, relationship, and relevance. And it has to start with the relationship.
You know, and I would imagine that children aren't thinking of it in terms of trust. They are not, particularly a grade school kid's not able to, you know, think of it that way, right? It's got to be the teacher.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Trust is the essence of what really makes a good teacher. When the kids really do trust that adult in the classroom and the adult really trusts the kids in the classroom, that's just, to me, the winning combination. And successful things will occur. And it doesn't matter if it's in the wealthiest school system or the poorest. It really is. And I agree with what Jeff says. Trust is
that. I obviously agree with you. yet, you know, when we approach this, it's sort of, we'll give you a quick scenario would be, I gave a test, okay, all the material that, you know, we discovered, you know, in our inquiry, whatever we did, okay, and the kid doesn't do well. At that point, I have to make a decision. Is a grade more important or is the kid's learning more important? And the learning is more important. And so why wouldn't I allow that child, why wouldn't I reteach that child, or why wouldn't I let that child, you know, not bring in a box of Kleenex to make up, you know, to get 15 more points on the test or something, but really to master the material. And by having that, I used to call it remediation, you know, and by having the child learn the stuff that they didn't know, learn the material before that they didn't know before, and being successful, I mean, the look on their face and in their eyes is all the pay you need. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing what happens to kids when they go from, oh my gosh, I can't even get this, to, wow, now I've really got it. It's mm-hmm. so meaningful to them.
And what you're talking about, too, is the fact that the child does trust you because they're willing to come back and try again. There's that element of, I believe in you because you believe in me, and I'm willing to give this another shot.
Absolutely.
You know, I can think of the children that I've taught in Australia, and, you know, if you haven't got that foundation there, those processes to build that trust, then more likely than not, that child is not going to attempt, because if they attempt a test and they fail it, then they have to attribute it to the fact that they didn't know it or they didn't understand it. But if they don't even attempt the test, they can always say, well, if I tried, I might have done okay. So there's that strong foundation needs to be there for that child to try the test and then come back and try it again.
Jeff, it sounds like you're still pretty passionate.
You know, I'm going to be quite frank with you. As I'm sitting here talking, I have a woodwork furniture building business now, and there are no 25 to 30 kids, 16 to 18, sitting around here to interact with, and I'm going nuts. I got to tell you, it's only been 1 year since I've been retired, and I'm going crazy. You know, the other day, some past students from the 1990s came over Christmas break with some of their little 8-year-old kids, and we just had a ball, and I just went, oh, man.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you're out of the business.
Well, I think, quite frankly, it's very personal, of course. I'm going to have lunch with my wife, and I think I'm going to run past her, then I'm going to call my superintendent of my other district and say, listen, you got something for me to do, man?
well, good. Take care, and thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. I just want to squeeze in one more call before we have to say goodbye to our guest, Dave and Canal Winchester. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? I listen to you guys all the time, and, this one really intrigued me because I have two children. One was on a 504, one was on an IEP, and I feel like sometimes the teachers like to kick the children when they're down, and don't get me wrong, there's some great teachers out there. There's just a few that I think that they need tweaking a little bit, or, you know, that junior high level you were talking about earlier is a crucial point, I think, that you can build the children up, or you can kind of just, you know, make it so they don't want to go to school.
You know, you brought up a good, Dave, I don't want to interrupt you, but you brought up a good point. I want to get to it before we let our guests go. Belinda Gimbert and Dean Crystal from the OSU School of Education and Human Ecology. What happens with the bad teachers out there without getting into the whole union protection thing? But I want to ask them about it. There are some bad teachers out there. Everybody's got one. Every school's got one.
And it's like a coach. You know, you go to a sport and you're going to run into either a good coach or a bad coach. And it's no different than any other profession that we're in. But it's really crucial, I think, for our children. I think that's one of the reasons why we have such a huge dropout rate is because they're not motivating the children to want to even go to school, and I don't think they're teaching them that well, because I know you guys were talking earlier about, like, teaching them instead of just showing them, you know. It doesn't seem like they understand their homework. That's a big thing I'm finding out, because I noticed my kids were coming home and didn't understand any of the homework, and it was hard because I work evening hours, and my wife, it's tough for her to figure it out because she's dyslexic. So, you know, here I am coming home at 9 o'clock at night, and the kids got to get up at 5 in the morning, and it is just amazing.
Well, let's hear, because we're running out of time, Dave.
Okay,
Dave, thanks for your call. But
Dean
or Melinda?
Yeah, bad teachers. It's such a subjective term. I think if we're thinking about it in the way that reinvented and revamped teacher preparation programs are thinking about it now, it's looking at who comes into the pipeline to become a teacher. You know, once upon a time, it was the high school graduate who just funneled into self-selected into a teacher prep program. Of course, we still have that very important group. But now the multiple pathways, the innovative, creative pathways for which other adults can come into teaching are helping us to figure out what kinds of strengths, what kind of personality traits, what kind of skill set is really required in the classroom of a teacher. And I think that gives us an opportunity to sort of really think about the most highly effective teachers so that we can kind of move away from this three-letter word, bad, when they're in the classroom. You know, the goal is to prepare the most highly effective teachers and have them grow professionally as they teach with the school systems. But that said, we know 10% of a healthy organization also lets go of its employees each year, and we need to have rigorous teacher evaluation programs that enable teachers to identify their strengths and weaknesses and either choose to build their weaknesses into strengths or choose to find another occupation.
Well, Belinda Gimbert, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
That's Dr. Belinda Gimbert. She's an associate professor in the OSU School of Educational and Human Ecology. And also Dean Crystal. Thanks, Dean, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Dean Crystal. He's an associate professor and the academic coordinator of educational programs at OSU Lima. Coming up, we're going to talk about another aspect of education and how it's treated in the theater. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Gene Robinson reflects on his time as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's just retired. For years, Robinson received death threats. One suspect was arrested with photos of Robinson.
He had scrawled across them, "Save the church, kill the bishop," and he had a sawed-off shotgun and tons of ammunition.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher for a discussion of the fiscal cliff scenario that took place in the 1930s and its relation to present-day issues. And then it's Tech Tuesday with the latest on technology and gadgets. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 a.m. to noon. And be prepared to laugh as Pioneers of Television presents Funny Ladies. It's Tuesday night on WOSU-TV. See the first female stand-up comedians to appear on television and the sitcom stars who followed. Hear from Phyllis Diller, Joan Rivers, Betty White, and Tina Fey, and many more. Watch Funny Ladies. It's Tuesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. Partly sunny skies today, a high near 34. Cloudy tonight, a low of 23 degrees. Sunny and a high of 36 on Tuesday, more sunshine and a high near 40 on Wednesday. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, helping families eliminate worry, reduce stress, and reestablish personal freedom. Serving Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye, goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye, goodbye. With a cheer, not a tear, make it day. Give me a smile.
That is from the Available Light Theater Company's latest production of The History Boys. The play tells the story of a group of students and teachers at a British high school during the early 1980s. For information about the showtimes and more, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now to discuss the production is Available Light Theater's artistic director, Matt Slabaugh. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
The show's doing very well. It's been sold out.
Yes, yeah, we've had packed houses. We've been, in fact, having to turn people away at the door, which I have to tell you is really heartbreaking for us. So we really hate disappointing people.
Right.
Yes, of course. It's wonderful to have an excited audience as well. But there are still some tickets available. And, of course, every night we make sure we have some held at the door for our Pay What You Want program as well.
So check out the website at our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you're interested. So the story is about two teachers in an all-male school. One is all about helping the students get the grades that'll help them get ahead. And yes. The other one loves to teach and share knowledge for its own sake. They conflict on this issue.
They do. They very much conflict on the issue. It's really a microcosm, obviously, for a lot of the conflicts that have been going on in modern education. Even things that I see in my role as a teacher. I teach at CCAD. And Irwin is a young, very bright teacher who's been brought in, but very specifically with the task of preparing them for entrance exams and interviews to help them get into college and get onto a good career. Hector is the beloved teacher who obviously is the center of the play. He's wonderful, full of knowledge. The students love their time with him, but he's not necessarily specifically concerned with those achievements. Yes, as you said, knowledge for its own sake.
You teach.
I do.
At Otterbein and CCAD.
That's right.
What do you see reflected in your students at those schools that you brought to the table with this production?
Well, at Otterbein, I teach theater students, and I think it's fair to say that even for theater students, folks who are definitively in the arts and all about creativity, even in that realm, and even as freshmen at Otterbein, they are already looking ahead to their career path, knowing, especially in theater, because it's so specific. Most people, if you go to your family Christmas event and tell your Aunt May that you're going into the theater program, she says, "Oh, so we'll see your name on the big lights of Broadway,
or you'll
right?
be a starving artist for the rest of your life."
right, exactly. Or then Uncle Jim says, "Oh, you've learned to say, do you want fries with that, haven't you?" Those are sort of the standard jokes. So even in our students at Otterbein, we already see that they're thinking about What am I trying to do? What do I have to do to get to New York and to make it there? Or, you know, or you're the ones that have other career paths. There are already some who say, I want to start my own theater company like you did. What do I have to do in order to make it? And of course, that's so difficult because as much as we think there are, you know, these steps A, B, C, and D to go through, that isn't necessarily all the way it works in the theater or in any other career, obviously.
And then meanwhile, you're also trying to tap into that creative streak in them that's going to help them discover whole new things and approaches to theater in general.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at every different person who's on the faculty at Otterbein, they've all had a different journey through the world of the theater, through the world of becoming an adult, becoming a full-fledged human being. And some of them have had great success in a more traditional career path. Some of them have had great success in non-traditional career paths. And so we really feel like it's part of our job not only to point out here are the stepping stones, but also think about what other ways you might want to go about it, and also preparing them for the world. We had a guest recently who's a playwright in New York, and he warned them, Broadway is not the finish line. You may get through school and make your Broadway debut, as many people have, and then what are you going to do then? That's not the end of it. And in fact, you know, just because you've made it there doesn't mean you'll be there for the rest of your life.
Are there grade grubbers in theater schools?
Grade grubbers?
Yeah, the one that they have to get the A. How does it translate? Because it's such a different, you know, curriculum, I guess,
sure,
than a lot of the, say, you know, science, math.
Yeah. Well, there are definitely students who clearly are more geared towards saying, like, okay, please, I need you to break this down for me a little more black and white. What do I got to do to get the A? And not in necessarily even a grade grubbing way, but just maybe that's more of their experience in school. So as we spend more time being a little bit more vague and open-ended, they don't quite feel comfortable, right? There certainly are students who want to make sure I'm doing the things I have to check off my list, right? Which is totally understandable because they're already thinking, well, I got to get an A in this class because, you know, that leads to this, leads to this, leads to that.
The building blocks of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Matt Slabaugh. He is the artistic director for Available Light Theater Company, and their new production is The History Boys. There's still lots of shows left. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's a fun story, but it revolves around some serious educational issues and the idea of whether it's more important to get an A on a test or learn how to learn for the long haul. How does it resolve? Without, you know, no,
well, yeah,
no spoilers.
I don't want to give away the ending.
Of course, there's some very seriously adult issues that deal with sexuality and that sort of thing as well.
That's also true. And in fact, that's what I would say is that the play does a really great job. You know, there are 8 students in the class, and you do get sort of at the end, this one went on to become a lawyer, this one went this way, like at the end of a John Hughes movie from the 80s.
Right.
So the play does a really balanced job of showing how some of the students really benefited from this. Some of them didn't benefit. Some of them, their experience with Hector, the more knowledge for its own sake geared teacher, some of them benefited more from that. So there is a range in the way things end up. So the play is very fair in that way. Both teachers get their due.
The point being that lots of kids need lots of different approaches.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't, and I mean, personally, that's how I feel. You can't just teach to the text. The thing is that children need individual attention. Kids need you to pay attention to their needs and as they're developing. And that's something in the theater program that we're very able to do. It's a, you know, smaller group of people, so we're very much attuned to what we need to bring out, the talents in each of those students. And so that's kind of where the play comes down on that. But it's certainly a rocky road along the way of the play. We see the struggles and even how it affects these teachers personally. There are 2 other characters. There's another teacher, Mrs. Lintott, who's in the play, and she's sort of the matronly, I think, teacher who's been there for a long time, very much concerned about the kids and sort of is also able to put both Irwin and Hector in their place and show you that middle ground. And then there's the headmaster who's something of a comic character. He's very, very concerned with the success of the school At the beginning of the play, the school is sort of a maybe a little bit run down. It's definitely not top of the list. And so he's really reaching. He's really counting on Irwin to get them some stars and really get them some acclaim. So it's pretty obvious that his desires are not entirely honorable. You know, he wants some recognition for his students, but also for himself and for his program. He wants to pull them up a bit.
How do you, when you're talking with the actors, and I know you didn't direct the show, but, in the course of preparing people to be students in a show like this, what do you do to prepare them for that? Because you have the disaffected ones, you have the super earnest ones. How do you...
Sure. Well, the cast has an enormous amount of fun, which they did in rehearsal. We saw it. They've been working on this play for quite a while. They started in November because there's all the holidays and such in between. So they've had a lot of time to really come together as a group. We made them shave off all their facial hair so they look baby-faced. I think that's a really important part of it. But the main thing is them cohering as this group of students would, who in this situation have been in school together for a long time. They know each other really, really well. And you'll see in each of them, I see when I watch the play, I watch Jordan Fair as Dakin, and I say, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. I didn't like that guy very much, actually. And there's another one of the students, and I won't give away which, but there's definitely one that I say, that's me. I absolutely remember being just like that guy. So they really have unique personalities, and they do a great job of they've clearly identified what it is that these students need and what it is that they want and where they think they're going in the future. And so their unique identities are really, really fun to watch on stage. The way they interact, almost like watching a basketball team or something with that kind of chemistry. It's really fantastic.
My guest once again is Matt Slabaugh. He is artistic director for the Available Light Theater Company. Their new show is The History Boys. If you have a question or comment for Matt, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I know a show like The History Boys isn't going to respond to everything that's going on out there right now, but obviously the whole issue of education and teaching is really at the forefront of so many conversations nowadays. Why did you decide to do it now? Was that because it is in the news so much?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, there's several things. One, it's a play that the director, Drew Eberle, had loved for quite a long time. Education is one of those topics that that we talk a lot about as a group, partially because so many of us are teachers, partially because some of us have kids. And so it was something we had wanted to find a way to talk about. And sometimes we do that by creating our own show from scratch, and sometimes we look around for something that already exists. But really what it comes down to is that we all read the play and just responded to it so strongly because it's so beautiful. It's really, really, the characters are wonderfully drawn. We really identified with the issues and also what the characters are going through. There's a really wonderful love of words and of literature and a love of learning that's at the heart of the play. No matter which side you come down on in the end, it's very, very clear that the love of helping these kids find themselves is really what's at the center of all the characters' desires and their motivations.
You've done other shows about education.
Education is learning is always at the center of everything we do. We find it very powerful. One of the things we think about when we're choosing shows is the many different things that theater can do, the different human needs that it can fulfill: learning, spectacle, empathy, magic, that sort of thing. And for us, we've really realized over time that learning is something that we want to be at the heart of everything we do. So this, in a way, doing a play that's about education is almost just a more direct way of addressing that issue. But yes, even when we do shows, the food play is a big one that we did last year. I mean, that was a lot about educating ourselves. We all took a year to learn about, you know, the food system in order that we could talk about it and ask questions about it in the show. So we always talk about the fact that one of the reasons we do theater is as a way of understanding the world around us. We are all constantly in adult education classes together by way of making theater. That's very important to us.
Did you have a favorite teacher growing up?
I had several favorite teachers. Yeah, I have to say, I had a lot of teachers that influenced me quite a bit.
Tell me about one.
okay, I'm feeling shy for some reason. Mrs. Sulzer was our gifted education and English teacher in middle school. And so she taught me for 2 years. And, of course, middle school is just the worst of all times for...
So important, yet so... So troublesome.
So troublesome, so difficult, trying to figure out who you are. And she was a teacher who was really wonderful in encouraging all of us to really find what was special about ourselves, to figure out what it was that we cared about and what we were passionate about in school, but also in the world. And one of the first teachers that really sort of opened my mind to the relationship between what it is that we're doing in the classroom and what's going on in the rest of the world. And I've always remembered her for that.
In the show, the female teacher says that Hector teaches in the way he does because he wants to be remembered. It is interesting to think about wanting kids to remember you or the legacy of teaching.
Yeah.
We heard earlier in the program, Jeff from Worthington, the teacher who's obviously still extremely passionate. He's obviously still a teacher, but he's retired. I'd love to talk to some of his former students. Yeah.
Sure. You can't help it. I mean, even at Otterbein, I mean, certainly at Otterbein, and I think it's partially because we're in the theater program, so they're obviously keeping track of their alumni and the things that they go on to do. And it is very gratifying. I know some of my fellow teachers have students they've kept in touch with long after they've left school. And, of course, it's wonderful to see that they're having success and to know that even a small part of that success is attributable to something that you did in the class. It's vindication, isn't it? It's really wonderful. And you wouldn't want to think that that's the reason you're doing it, of course, and maybe that's why they think Hector is possibly flawed, that he has that in mind more than most in the play. But it's certainly a really, 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 really wonderful feeling. Even as a director of plays, to have actors that we've worked with who go on to further success and do better things and then come back and say, you know, that thing we did in rehearsal that day, I always take that with me. That's an incredible feeling to know that you can actually have a tangible influence on somebody else's success.
What kind of feedback are you getting from the audience on this?
Wow. Wonderful feedback. Rapturous feedback, actually. Sunday afternoon, I came in the theater. The show had started. I went away, did some things, came back as it was ending. We opened the doors up to the theater, and people are yelling, "Bravo!" John Kuhn's performance as Hector, no matter what you think of the character at the end of the play, his performance is absolutely incredible. I mean, he will have you laughing and wanting to jump out of your chair and cheer, and then really breaking down in tears later. You don't want to overstate it, but it's about as close to a tour de force as I've seen in the area in a while. It's really great.
We are ending the show with music as we started the segment and from the show. And I wonder if you could explain the music. The boys sing in the show. They sing very well. We heard some of the outset. What's the purpose of that?
Well, the boys, part of their classes with Hector, one of the things you find out is that he's not necessarily teaching to the syllabus. And so they're spending a lot of time singing in their general studies classes. And we happen to have a cast of boys who sing very, very well and sing very well together. Pam Welsh Huggins, their music director, did some arrangements with them. And so I think what we're going to hear is a more contemporary song that's been arranged for their a cappella group. Easy to imagine the boys wanted to learn something of their own. And this is what we've learned, and we hear this at the end of the play.
All right, Matt Slabaugh, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you again.
Matt Slabaugh, Artistic Director for the Available Light Theater Company. Their production right now is called The History Boys. We have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. Thanks for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.